Mass Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is now 3:04 p.m. on Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. We are in Capitol Order 106. Members present are Denise Rivers, Christina Kochetter, Representative Zopetsky, and Representative Sponholz. Yes, on the line telephonically, and myself from the Senate co-chair today. I want to start by thanking our House Record staff, Lauren Holland, Tanya Aim, for moderating today's meeting and making this meeting possible. At the Record Factory, please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you very much. So today we are going to hear an overview from the Department of Health and Social Services and Executive Order 121, DHSS reorganization. To recap, but I think everyone's sitting here in this room knows, it is an executive order to bifurcate the department into the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. A version of this was introduced last session, but was withdrawn by the administration. And we are now, that previous was EO-118, today we are looking at EO-121. My staff electronically sent the documents to members and other staff as soon as we received them from the department last night. Members should have the following documents. We have a letter that we received summarizing the various documents that came through. We have a type of lending attachment A. The accreditation from the U.S. Department of Health and Social Services. We have attachment E, which is the textual analysis. Attachment C is titled the sampler of stakeholder outreach. We have attachment D, implementation, Department of Health and Social Services transition plan, and implementation of the executive order. Attachment E, which is the summary of new and reclassified positions. And attachment F, this is a table of questions submitted to the department from my office and including their responses. We'll primarily be going over the presentation today. At the end of one, we have presenting Commissioner Adam Crum with the department, who is Stacey Crowley, Director of the Civil Division Department of Law. And I believe we have a phone that is available for questions. Do we have Dr. Anzik with us today? Yes, Dr. Anzik, Chief Medical Officer, Governor Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor. Yes. And Christine Massian, Program Coordinator. In the interest of time, I recognize that we have a lot of information, and there will likely be a lot of questions. I'll pause it when you're able to throughout the presentation and give my manager a heads up when we'll do questions. Pre-chair is not asking, do you have any questions or comments before we begin? Thank you. So, we are going to start with Ms. Crowley, Director of the Civil Division Department of Law, if you would like to come up. And you would like to come from the record and begin. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stacey Crowley. I'm the Civil Division Director for the Department of Law. Prior to my position, I was the Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Human Services Section and representing DHSS for just over 2 decades. So I've been around the game for a while. As I understand, Madam Chair, just to confirm the proceedings here, we do have a statute of the office. This is based on the document. I don't think you want me to read the section, but you can kind of really brief overview of what the document has. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay. Just didn't want to bring that myself. So, as I have been thinking about this and trying to determine how to best kind of frame this, this document, I think the best way to explain it is using the ever-found pyramid of the stool analogy. There are three parts to this executive order. One which creates the two departments, which creates the Department of Health and the Department of Family services. And it goes down into the report covering the statute, page 39, Title 47, and Title 44 increases to departments. So originally, DHSS is identified in the state organizational framework under the Alaska statute under 4429, and that's the Department of Health and Social Services. What we've done is we've taken that statute and created the 100, and then we've added another chapter to Title 44, which creates and also there is similar kind of bifurcation in our 4730, which is the major statutory framework for what is the accredited DHSS. So that's the part one. That's why I use it in creating the two departments. The other part of this meeting for does take the number of boards and commissions that are currently outlined in the U.S. and the statutory authority and moves them to their respective departments under Title 44. So as you know, Title 44 is a term designed to title state organization. And each department has its own chapter within that organization. So like I said, we create Department of Health, we create the Department of Family and Community Services. But what we've done is taken all of the boards and advocacy groups that are currently under DHSS and move it to an appropriate department in Title 44. So what we do is we moved the mental health trust authority and the long-term care home ombudsman's office to the Department of Revenue, where they are currently housed, basically, in the room by budget and by operations. We have moved them out of the building to Title 47 and DHSS and moved them to Title 44. We've also taken a number of boards and moved them under DHSS under the Department of Health and under the Department of Revenue. But we've moved the in-house case office and special education, the Commission on Aging, and also the health board and the State Bank Enterprise Building Council to the Department of Health. The advisory board of Council on Aging Services and Prevention Council are currently under Title 34, so you're going to take this again. All of the boards that have previously been housed under DHSS are now housed under Title 44. They're not mixed in between the substantive statutory provisions that govern the department as it exists today. The one page, the Biennial Pioneer Home Advisory Board is also, is proposed in Title 44. We'll get to family community services because that's where the Pioneer Home Board of the Pioneer Home will be located. So that was the second link of my three-day disability action. Moving all of these boards and commissions to the appropriate departments under Title 44. We did that for a particular reason, as far as becoming clear from an organizational standpoint. It makes sense to make this the boards, which have very unique rules and obligations under their statutory scheme, we make that part of the day-to-day statutory obligations that the department has to exist now or the department has to exist in the future. It's also a little confusing at times, especially with the mental health trust and the long-term care ombudsman, because we don't have any oversight over those boards or those entities. And the house number 4730 from here, so it just makes sense from an organizational standpoint and an operational standpoint to clean some of that up. So the third part of the school is kind of the technical part of the analogy, which is basically all of the reporting agreements that have to happen over the course of the entire, again, those statutory provisions that DHSS is involved in. Going from audits to background checks to centralized licensing. There are all sorts of different things that have to happen when you have to make sure the right department is tied to the right program is tied to the right department. So there's a lot of pages of moving parts that have to go to stop. And that's the third part of this analogy that I'm giving you. And included with that would be section of statute that are repealed because they're no longer in effect, because we had done it again then, because we already dealt with them elsewhere. Or we also include instructions to the revise those statutes where we, after they're moving through
and years of my career, but that really naturally depends on the people to those places. So you've got to go through, and I think there's a crosswalk within your pathway that is similar to what educators and practitioners go into many, maybe kind of came out there after those. You've got a similar crosswalk with conversations with legislative people, so we can just work out through the fact.
Thank you. Any additional questions? At this point, do I have any by Commissioner Fetmer? Thank you, Director. Welcome, whenever you are ready.
Certificates, marriage licenses, public health, emergency medical services, and behavioral health and more. Because of the breadth and depth of the services we provide, at some point you will interact with us. Signature Because of these interfunding sources and roles, banks at the commission cannot simply delegate it down. This would be the same problem for anyone who follows the U.S. position. To manage this responsibility requires due diligence, meetings with federal partners, audits, active actions addressed, compliance concerns, etc., creating an actual bottleneck in the organizational design. One that can't be corrected but just more deputies, it requires new legal lines of authority and focus. On top of this, part of state statutes to prove that outgoing commissioner authorities further limiting the ability to delegate. This is a problem. It was a problem for our predecessors, and will continue to be a problem for any administrations that follow if this kind of structure persists. And when you look at the diverse array of agencies that we work with and receive funding from, which obviously may be the most important right now, but I get the phone call from the administration of children and families about helping to repatriate American citizens on a flight from Wuhan, or do I continue to focus on Medicaid innovations and negotiations with CMS? Or do I lift different funding sources to ask states to redefine how child care assistance is delivered in areas from their states? Is that more time and energy than recovering from a cyber attack that delays grant payments to behavioral health providers? These are painful decisions. And the leadership roles are naturally encumbered with difficult decisions and client management concerns. It's difficult to know that actions in need are asking for help and structures working as a natural barrier towards rapid and appropriate response. So we talked about programs and funding sources. So let's talk about the number of employees in this. It's one thing for large organizations to exist and be geographically spread out, but they typically have just a handful of key services they provide to many folks in general. But it is quite the managerial and administrative task to juggle all aspects of providing the wide array of services we do across the state the size of Alaska and with more employees than residents of Pennsylvania or Petersburg. Health and Social Services has as many employees as five other state departments, legislature, and the governor's office combined. There are multiple divisions in this that have more employees than other departments, and all of these large divisions answer back to a single commissioner's office. The Department of Health and Social Services budget is more than 12 departments, the legislature, the governor's office, and the judiciary combined. There's no other limit. Our budget is nearly 30% of the state net budget in FY23. Being such a massive and diverse department means that the work it has interacts with and affects every other state department. So improving service delivery to health and social services can help other departments provide better service to Alaskans. It is our normal course of business to reach out and work with other departments. So working with one more department will be an easy transition. A couple examples on the slide include the Department of Corrections, right? Reentry services for people who need corrections to go back to the community with behavioral health. Department of Early Education, we're going to early childhood development after school programs and a lot of grants that we can help administer and take care of them. And in the department, there is a role that we play in interacting with them. So, when we're doing programs like Medicaid, public health, and behavioral health, really easy to see the interaction with other departments. We get a lot of surprising work and program coordination, such as working with Fish and Game for special eligibility areas in the state to use SNAP benefits to purchase hunting and fishing licenses and even sporting game equipment. We also have the Make a Fair program, use program benefits to be eligible to be used in local farmers markets all across the state, which intersects with the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Natural Resources. Also, most of us have seen or heard about the Kids in Food campaign. This actually was now fully managed by DNR Natural Resources, but started as a cross collaboration between us and the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you for sharing. So, I may be just a moment. I wanted to give the opportunity for any questions that our committee members may have on the overview of the size and operation of this before we shift gears. Representative Stephens, any questions on the way? Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you for your work. So, all of the above-mentioned programs in massive budget are performed under the current structure of health and social services. So what can be done to reduce the staff control, narrow the focus of management and staff, as well as be more responsive over time to stakeholders and employees? This is the solution. To reorganize the Department of Health and Social Services into two separate departments that reduce the staff control and align functionality. Because when the census turns and 100,000 for review, there are really two key functional areas. One, providing direct care and patients to clients, 24/7 facility in the community, and State Public Health and Community Services. And two, managing the payment and processing programs at the Department of Health. Aligning these functions allows the commissioner's office and policy staff to focus on supporting staff to improve work processes, improving services delivered to the residents, and creating the bandwidth necessary for further engagement with stakeholders and federal partners to lead towards innovation. This slide shows the current structure of the Department of Health and Social Services and what we call the plug-and-play method, which we are using to move existing divisions into the new home departments. The Department of Health consists of the Medicaid divisions of Healthcare Services, Behavioral Health, Seniors and Disability Services, and those will also be aligned with Public Assistance and Public Health. This aligns our payment processes with programs and allows future innovations, such as moving towards value-based care, further enhancing the shared vision of the PPE community, and focusing on client health prevention efforts. The Department of Family and Community Services, or BFCS, will consist of facility-based divisions, such as the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Division of Juvenile Justice, and the Pioneer Homes, along with around-the-clock community services of the Office of Children's Services. This aligns the divisions that provide direct care. It makes time for specific attention on issues such as OCS recruitment and retention, time-related community discussions on future investment in Pioneer Homes, not to mention that issues can come from facility-based entities, such as deferred maintenance and licensing issues. This framework was designed in such a way to minimize any disruption in services to beneficiaries or payments to providers. This is achieved by keeping the public-facing divisions intact and the leadership changes and no change in footprint. It should be noted that to keep services aligned, designated evaluation and treatment services, or DEP services, will be moved from the Division of Behavioral Health to the Department of Family and Community Services in order to stay closely aligned with EPI and help coordinate Title 47 and voluntary commitment patient movement between facilities. This aligns with planning and statutes to the oversight of the Department of Family and Community Services. On the right side of your screen, you see a highlighted box around Finance and Management Services being commissioner staff. The primary changes in this report will occur to the Internal Division of Finance and Management Services, or FMS, which will divide staff to cover each department. These involve sections of IT, rents and contracts, and finance and budget. We are asking for some new positions and reclassified positions to fill out the FMS staff and commissioner's office staff.
Commissioner, I'll jump in with a question here, perhaps some of my colleagues will have some as well. So in looking at this new org chart for the Department of Family and Community Services against the current org chart for the HESS, it appears that everything from the deputy commissioner down, who's overseeing the Pioneer Homes, Children's Services, and Human Justice, that remains unchanged, correct? So we're seeing the addition of a single commissioner or to oversee this half or so. Okay. I mean, I know you're going to get into it later, but can you give us a heads up? How many new positions are you looking at in this particular org chart?
So new positions total will be 11 new PCNs and 10 reclassified PCNs. And yes, you're correct that no whole structure is the current deputy commissioner, policy staff, adding the commissioner to that. We're also putting forward, I believe there's another project coordinator that's being added. But as you look also at the org chart, we have many of the roles that we've learned through stakeholder engagement on the bottom of the commissioner's staff is the department reorganization liaison and department liaison. While we're still sorting out, does this need to be designated people in those roles, or is it a designated role to an individual? this is something that we're continuing to work out over time to make sure that that is covered.
Thank you. Thank you. And I wrote myself a note and I received two notes and I didn't do it. Forgive me. I got pulled into the presentation. I would like to recognize that Representative Brooks arrived at 3:31 p.m. Thank you, Commissioner. Question? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Harms, what I'm thinking, I guess I'm a little bit on this point. Can you talk about the policy considerations? If you did the loan by community, as it relates to having DPI located at the Department of Family and Community Services, I think what you mentioned is community services. What sort of conversations have you had with behavioral health stakeholders and organizations and advocates about the integration of placing API into a separate department from behavioral health? And has the department done some considerations about potentially amending API back into behavioral health? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Thank you for the question. Good to hear from you, Mr. Kowalski. So Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, is an acute inpatient psychiatric hospital. And it's one of those we forget sometimes because it is a state agency, it is a hospital, which means that it provides services and it bills accordingly. And so the same thing is the same aspect with the Pioneer Home. Services that are under the doors of the Pioneer Home are billed against Medicare, Medicaid, private pay, pay assistance program, even Veterans Administration. And so API, having its specific licensing concerns as being a licensed CMS hospital, is appropriate there in the Department of Family and Community Services. And there's also a separate concern that's that in healthcare services in the Department of Health, we have the Healthcare Facility Licensing Division. And so this is a group that is contracted out by CMS and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to do surveys of licensing of hospitals around the state. And so there's always been a little bit of a question, is there a conflict of interest for the surveying group to be in the same department as the hospital that goes to oversee? And so this is one way for us to address that. And we've worked this across the board as well with the Division of Behavioral Health, because the Division of Behavioral Health doesn't provide services on their own. They are not providing counseling. They are managing the programs and facilitating providers around the state that actually provide services in the community. And so, one unique aspect about behavioral health is they already work with so many departments and across all branches. As an example, the APAN system, or the database they use, already works with the court system in the headquarters. It already works with the Department of Corrections and Public Safety. And so, they have these already data feeds that move information back and forth. Being in separate departments, we work with us and we've considered this. To use a formal memorandum of agreement between Division of Behavioral Health and API to make sure that the full life bioprocess assurance continues. This is something that we have considered. We have worked extensively upon this particular worked extensively with our stakeholders on. We've had a lot of conversations with groups like NAMI and ADAPOM, which was made with a follow up meeting just yesterday. We're trying to address this so they understand what is going on through this process.
That answers my question very well, thank you, Commissioner. I know that you mentioned on slide 14 under the Department of Family and Community Services, the department direction of whether the reorganization liaison or tribal liaison is a role or is it an individual in the context of the new PCNs, whether we classify PCNs that you mentioned.
Are the counties
either of those at this time?
It is either for versus no, not at this time. Because the majority of the new rules and reclassified rules are actually filling out some of the gaps by splitting up refinements and management services like the cost of divisions. One example being customer supports, customer services within our IT section. You look at Fairbanks, we have one managerial position there. For making sure we're serving both departments appropriately, we reclassified a position to a managerial role in order to cover the customer service side accordingly. And so that's where a lot of those gaps are coming from. But we do have some of our policy advisors and our project coordinators identified throughout.
Thank you.
want to talk a little bit more in depth about what those, whether it's your role or whether their responsibilities are an existing individual within the department or they're hired on as an OPC within the department. Can you talk about the scope of what these particular responsibilities already included in your curriculum?
Thank you, Representative Zukoski. So the Department of Organization Liaison actually came as a suggestion directly from our legal division. The idea behind this is that we have a staff, a single point of contact in the commissioner's office that is identified for both the public and advocacy groups to reach out to if there are concerns or issues that address after implementation begins. And so they will direct that into the commissioner's office, meaning that person has authority to reach out to other appropriate parts of the department to make sure. The other goal of that role is to make sure that they actually schedule the long-term follow-up, meaning that after implementation of July 1st, that we actually have convening sessions, town halls, and some other meetings to meet with stakeholders to see what are any other concerns going on, how are we doing, how are we getting this together. The travel liaison role is not taking any other existing ones. There actually is an existing administrative order for the San Juan African Executive Branch that all divisions have a travel liaison. That role is still going to exist because of the direct work that divisions do. It was in concert with working with our travel partners that was identified having a travel liaison named in the commissioner's office to make sure that formal processes are either continued or that there's a route for informal communication, as I was taught about. Because as we work with our travel partners across the board, it is critical that we continue these open lines of communication. I think one of the best aspects for our stakeholder industry has been the beauty and the benefit of working directly with them and how do we make sure that something is maintained for them. It is far too often it enters into the full consultation side, which is a very defined, prescriptive process with very limited interaction. This is something we actually want to make sure doesn't still exist as appropriate measures for the situations. But this bill of the travel liaison is to make sure we're having an issue with less issues before it gets to that point, and we're having to make sure we're working or strategizing the endeavor as we address federal partners.
Final thought. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, just to make sure I understand, you're just saying, correctly, Commissioner, both the department reorganization liaison and the travel liaison within family and community services, as well as within the Department of Health, the department has now made a determination on whether those will be specific positions or whether they will be incorporated into existing staff responsibilities. Is that correct?
In general, it's the process.
That's correct. Thank you. And just a final just to make sure that I understand a little bit more as well. Because that position is not renewed, they're not counted towards the PCNs or the recalls of PCNs yet.
Is there
a timeline that the department will be making a determination on that particular issue?
For example, Senator Cosby, if this, after 60 days, this does in fact become law, that is what we call our transition phase, upon which many of those decisions will be decided on the advance of the implementation date of July 1st. And so, in meeting with last week at the Investigative Health Board, later meeting the biannual event, we shared there with the chair that we're actually planning as we get closer with this going to an effect that we will actually do much more focused follow-up in our groups with key stakeholders at AMHB to make sure that these people are named and our programs of concern are actually directly addressed throughout our transition phase.
Thank you. I'd like to acknowledge that Representative Kelly joined us at 3:47. I'm going to return to my question because if you said it, I missed it, and if so, I apologize. By gathering, we have the 11 new PCNs. I will have a question about the number we get to assign to, and I will wait for that. And 10 reclassified positions specific to the Department of Family and Community Services. How many of those 11 and how many of those 10 will go to this department? How's that split up?
Madam Chair, if I could pull a lifeline to sum it up, because these are our documents, but I'm going to have to pay for it with you.
Okay, thank you. Whenever you're ready, put yourself on. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record. I'm Susan Rapp, the Assistant Commissioner. for health and safety services. The Department of Human and Community Services has six open positions and one open classified positions. Since we're honorable with questions, I will turn to Representative Spanholtz on the line to get an opportunity. Any questions? Thank you. I'm not seeing any more right now. If you'd like to continue, Commissioner.
Thank you so much. The trick remains my first report on this one. All right. So, for the Department of Health, or DOH, this campaign was designed to not disrupt service or public delivery. The senior change in leadership of divisions on the footprint, and the high-rated groups, again, like the Finance and Management Services and the Commissioner's Office, are truly the ones who are feeling the brunt of reorganization. If we're moving to slide 17,
this is where we are going to stop and pause for question and review. And I do have a question if we get back up to the Department of Health Board of Directors. So, if I'm remembering correctly, this organization is been changed from the first version of the EO, but it is changed slightly in that public assistance is now in the direct supervision of a commissioner, which I believe in the current organization chart, if I'm reading that correctly, is under the deputy commissioner. Is that accurate?
Commissioner, yes, that's correct. And one of the goals on it is we look towards public assistance through the governor's budget and capital request. This will be put forward by the members of the government to allow money for the need of public assistance. We do IT tech enhancement programs. And we do continue to oversight. One of the goals on this is kind of expedited affordables to make sure as we move through this, as we find different partnership with our federal partners on who's going to pay for what that we do in the world. This is also a coordination with some legislation which is moving through right now about adding executive to the state technological conservative division.
Thank you. Please continue.
So, if we go to slide 17, with the current structure of health and social services and its innumerable layers, issues that work their way up to the commissioner's office are to middle members that can quickly be extinguished with orderly fires. They require all layers on deck to make sure the entire thing doesn't burn down. With an additional commissioner's office and asset disparity control, the leadership will be more able to effectively work with stakeholders and employees to address concerns before they turn to internals. Speaking of internals, we have employed. This administration worked by crisis after crisis and has shown its focused leadership and support to lead to improved outcomes for Americans. But only in specific areas, and only if less time and attention is paid to other divisions. Some examples are an API that is on the verge of losing its license to operate as a hospital, but with very concerted efforts, it has a monthly governing board consisting of engaged members of the public and provider community, and staffing is most stable spent in many years. The Division of Public Assistance had at large 15,000 applications and multiple letters of direction from federal partners. Both new leadership, capital support, and willingness to embrace innovation, the backlog was eliminated and administrative efficiencies and savings were gained. During COVID, hundreds of millions of dollars for new assistance programs have flowed through the Division of Public Assistance. While this has required developing new processes and eligibility criteria, we were able to respond and move additional assistance checks out the door through Alaska, all while doing their normal course of business. This wouldn't have been possible with the DBA tools and setup a couple of years ago. In regards to the pandemic, it's safe to say that a majority of that time has been spent working with the public health, the governor's office, and the Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to provide resources to healthcare providers around the state and updated guidance to the public as well as industry partners. Alaska has done a tremendous job of one of the lowest fatality rates and has taken Herculean efforts and coordination from all corners of the state. These are just three examples of issues that affect Alaskans, but they services. These are all priorities. This is not to say that work is not being ongoing, but if their issues don't reach internal status, they don't get nearly as much time and attention. And so as we see here, these two games are a reminder that there is never a dull moment in health and social services. 24/7/365 are issues and crises. There will never be, so to speak, good time to make a move like this, but there is always a time and a place for decisive action. The only certainty is that with the current structure, we can do nothing but keep running from crisis to crisis. We have no idea what is around the corner, whether earthquake or outbreak. All the ideas for reorganization are not new, most of it came from division leaders who have had many years in the system to understand that Medicaid and health priority public health issues take all the area of the room. As a state, we are not putting in enough energy into innovating for the future. Facilities, programs, quality of care, etc. Because we are stuck in crisis mode all the time. All change is stressful, and all change is difficult, even good change. This isn't change for change's sake. Down the road, this will mean more bandwidth for everyone. More bandwidth for each commissioner's office and policy staff means more meaningful stakeholder engagement. Meaningful engagement takes time. Time to really listen to constituents, advocacy groups to address their concerns. Time to seriously engage with federal partners to seek Alaska-specific flexibilities. And time to do follow-up roundtables to know stakeholders can better respond in the first try. There is not enough time today for a single commissioner's office and policy staff to do meaningful engagement with the vast and frustrated stakeholders that this oversees. And this includes one of our biggest groups, our employees. There are over 3,000 Alaskans for health and social services who care deeply about what they do. But the important work performed by staff is rarely visible. Systems and programs are slow and cumbersome, and this all leads to frustration. Feedback cycle, negative emotions, and concerns. What time and bandwidth to address employee concerns and improve their experience will facilitate improved recruiting and retention? Probably health and social services is like an outbreak theater, a massive, self-contained ecosystem that is everything to everybody with a single captain. With so many facilities, so many staff, and so many programs, it's impossible for the commissioner's office to see and interact with all of them and to see and hear their concerns. This has been an issue in the past and will continue to be an issue for anyone who succeeds if we do not take action. Our employees deserve better. And our department should be able to more readily respond to and address their concerns, but to be frank, aircraft carriers are easier to turn than bureaucracies. The proposed structure of two smaller departments allows for a more nimble leadership response to fewer divisions. We are making the ship smaller and adding another captain. Fewer divisions in each department means less jacking for position on the priority list and a much more intentional approach to interacting with leadership. This will provide a direct benefit to our FMS staff, as usually unseen support groups will have to have expertise to serve all nine public-facing divisions and fund sources to go with it. With a smaller span of control, we'll be able to recruit and retain positions better, such as our finance officer, and grants and contract staff, instead of training them up to get a lateral transfer in a much smaller department for the same level of position. Because of the critical nature of their work, and FMS is running full steam ahead, it makes life easier for the other divisions. So executive orders are a useful tool that were specifically contemplated by Alaska's constitutional convention. Article 3, Section 23 says the governor may make changes in the organization of the executive branch when the establishment of functions among the units, which he considers necessary for efficient administration.
Structure
as it relates to city programs that we approach differently, having pros and cons. And I'm curious if the department has considered any sort of, has the department, I guess, gone through and trying to identify potential delays or challenges or roadblocks as it relates to the implementation of this executive order and made considerations and planned for the strikes and roadblocks. I guess it sounds great, and credit news can relate agency as a challenge, but also there are so many critical and crucial programs handled within the agency now, and we saw, as you mentioned, all of the things that can impact all of things, and we saw how the cyber attack has returned on all parts of a lot of things that I'm just curious to hear the department's planning around preparing for a worst-case scenario with the implementation of the U.S. Talk to that a little bit with us.
Thank you, Sarah, Representative O'Connor, and thank you for your question. As we went through this process, it really started coming from leadership and staff. Division directors have been many years. They brought forward that the current structure doesn't allow them to actually prioritize or they get bumped down the list too often. And so when we started examining that, we started working on this. And honestly, this is like the first iteration that we came up with. At one point, we were considering, maybe we need to do this. Okay, South Dakota's not there, they've got four. Then you realize, okay, Alaska's probably going to have an appetite for that. What is the most pragmatic way possible that doesn't break up existing public-facing divisions of the programs that are offered, but can actually allow for internal administrative changes in the program over time? And so we have looked at a lot of things like that. So something that actually is a part of our implementation plan that we try to think of both because of the cyber attack and because we are what's called a HIPAA covered entity and an office of civil rights is that our cybersecurity office has very specific roles. And so as we look at this, it takes a long time to make sure that you're doing correct things and that you're protecting a lot of this privacy and data. And so on that, one of the things we're doing launching our transition is we're keeping our cybersecurity office full. It's going to actually stay and resign with the Department of Health. And we're going to what's called RSA, a work across agency, to help maintain those services as well for the Department of Family and Community Services. And you're going to maintain covered HIPAA entity status for both departments. Over time, part of the consideration is because it's a big part from the Department of Law and our privacy officers, is it more appropriate for the Department of Family and Community Services to move to a favored HIPAA entity status, particularly amongst OCF? So it's easier for the field workers to actually do mobile device management and other aspects. The other consideration is the cyber attack. Because we're continuing to do our remediation and get programs back online, we do not want to halt or stall the efforts by the cybersecurity office. And if I may, because we have kind of made the point that our public facing divisions and the beneficiaries that directly serve the public, we're really trying to keep hold. And FMS, Finance and Management Services, the internal little engine that keeps us running, are the groups that are handling the brunt of this. And somewhere on the season of show being there's come some of these kind of unforeseen things that we're trying to anticipate and kind of put this together.
Yeah, thank you,
Chris.
I'm reading and we have a champion in the Department of Administration, and Commission on Personnel and Labor Relations, the Office of Information Technology, working through planning for the implementation, you know, thinking through not just how we get there, but also how we care for our public and civil, the end point and the point of transition, as the commissioner has indicated or deeply in our goal is to make sure that for all the people who count on our services and the local benefits, it is a release from the transition. And first off, we've got to be ready to show up to labor services on June 30th and not July 1st. And we need to make sure that those will be able to do that. So we are deep into that and planning on how to ensure that that happens. But, Medicare, thank you both for that answer. I guess I'll use an example. It's a little bit like when I look back at the impact of the cyber attack happening very actively during subsequent instances of the global pandemic, which left many hospitals and facilities doing a little bit of providing clean effort, duct taping it together with respect to background checks done, and something that the department could be able to be nimble in finding solutions to that. I guess more explicitly, have the department mapped out those types of potential scenarios across the labor-life programs that you provide to life friends to ensure that those crucial program stacks don't impact the most vulnerable Alaskans and the moments when they need these programs the most.
Madam Chair, I'll finish the answer to the capacity for the Police Commissioner to come. Yes, we've worked on it as much as we possibly can. We do have confidence in operations plans where they're continually updating as we go about the process. Cyber attack is a massive learning opportunity, trying to figure that out in a positive way. Because it's what we've done since then, hardening our systems, or making them much more resistant towards follow-up attacks. And other things we've really expedited across the board is multi-factor authentication for signing. So if you're on a new device, you have to get the top story, the configurator, to do that. That right there is an exponential level of safety and security that gets added to just by having that connected to individuals. And so those are little things like that that help us throughout this process. And when we try to learn how much of that as we go through this, we have learned it. We're prepared for everything that happens in health and social services or at the state. But we do have an extensive book, and we're building up quite the rapid tomorrow to be able to respond to situations, particularly with help from our friends at the Department of Law and Emergency Management.
Yeah, follow-up, do a question about your one question, and I appreciate the content of slides 19 and 20, and as we reach back to slides 15, I'm calling in and talking about what you believe to be the improved results and measures of executive order 121. Can you share with us, we have a lot of dialogue, particularly during the budget subcommittee process, really digging into metrics of success, if you will, with respect to state agency programs at the budget subcommittee level. And certainly for a transition of this magnitude, the department has conducted a thorough analysis identifying areas of programmatic improvement beyond, beyond what are somewhat subjective metrics related to improvements across the department. Can you share with us what has the department done, that you believe to be regular anticipated metrics and related benchmarks that you believe will be achieved through this strategic investment? So maybe you can reframe that question through the various programs throughout HES now. Where there are measures of success that we identify to this point, just for your program that we're provided, and do you have that information that you can follow up and share with the committee?
Yeah, the chair, Representative Lopasky, yes, we did a good follow-up, but as this as an example, particularly as a near-term goal that we're really trying to measure, is actually our recruitment and retention of finance management staff. Making sure that we have a full budget, finance, grants, and contract teams are items that we really believe are very possible because of the reorganization, because of the experience and the knowledge across our individuals we're going back to 5 and 4. It's easier to bring staff in, and the better that staff is coming, the easier it is to get responses for other divisions. And so there's a number of other items, in particular, is the high vacancy rate of the Office of Children and Services, which is one of the direct focuses on an item like this, because we want to make sure that it's separated from the Medicaid conversation. The Medicaid conversation being such a huge part of the budget, but not so focused on Office of Children and Services, how are we integrating across the board with our other community-based services. And so we can get better at that in the community.
So thank you very much, and here we are. Yes, it saw me as your weak slave into the night, and you stand on the words. A couple of things. First, adherence, matrix you looked at was objective, evaluation of efficacy as well as subjective. A lot of projects hearing about that, and I maybe need to hear more what that really looks like in a very visual format that we see, and I'm assuming that our baseline is now not planning for a baseline to put that in the future, but we're using the baseline now. And so when I see efficacy of programs that we're using this baseline here, and we have the matrix that we're going to be looking at to see efficacy. So as comments were made, I thought, do we have any change out of here that you actually are seeing? Seeking because we're going to be able to offer services more effectively to helpful hospitals. So I think that's what we're
after. It's not a chair representative, but I'm going to touch on the fact that it doesn't have an effect of being my first. I apologize for putting that in the words. But we're saying that the world's not going to get from the increase in July 1st more than all of them turning to original consumption. Because what we see is programs will continue on as they are, but this change with how we can engage with public and providers going forward. There will be some near-term changes in our immediate staff ability, but as we focus on and address other items, it's going to be left longer term. But we believe that this is the path we're going to go forward.
I think it's going to be this thing, and it's how we back when and they start the whole thing, and how today they've been done so quickly and not even know that it happened. And that is what departments experienced, not anticipated something like that. So, for these services, for OCS to do effective services, and yet be able to get the information on our workers to be able to get the information out to families.
OCS has been a long-standing issue at all the hospitals we've been with, and there's a lot of areas of concern there. Areas that we see positive movement forward would be working on positive mobile device management to make sure that our folks are covered in the field with other equipment. There's some concerned things which we're currently working on a couple of issues with. When it comes to some of the HIPAA-covered services that we offer, like Office 365, and there's the security certificates, other aspects we're trying to do is work with electronic document management and how we're transferring information back and forth between offices. These are things that we're looking to implement and try to improve. I'm not saying that in the government budget, there will be some items that are going to be putting forward using PDF to really help some of the items that we're seeing at OCS, while we're hopefully in addressing some of the evidence-based programs. So we do have access to a little bit more federal reimbursement on things that work in community. So, at that reference, the school has offered up to this slide in my home region. So, why not? Because executive orders are well defined and the process is prescribed. Executive orders cannot have substantive law change. This means programs and services won't be changed by the EO. This provides certain stakeholders and beneficiaries that their programs will continue on unaltered throughout the EO process. The definitive timeline is laid out in Article 3, Section 23 of the state constitution is another touchdown of certainty. As opposed to legislative process where timelines can vary greatly and services can be altered by amendments. So in slide 23,
executive orders have been used many times to realign state agencies for better service to the public. In 2003, the Pioneer Funds ran the Department of Administration in executive order 108 to adjust to move them to Health and Social Services. Corrections was historically a part of the Department of Health and Social Services, and they didn't become their own department until 1984 by executive order. In fact, Executive Order 54, to split out corrections, was put forward in 1983 but was disapproved. It was worked on and then reintroduced the following year as Executive Order 55, which became law. This really highlights that the process works. The legislature provided input, and ultimately the correct change was made. Furthermore, we know that there could be bumps, and future legislation may be needed to fill some gaps. An example of that, Civil Division Director currently mentioned, is a bill that might be needed to get the Commissioner of the Department of Family and Community Services a statutory advisor to the Mental Health Trust. So we appreciate all of our legislative partners look forward to working together to set the two departments for success. And that brings us to the timeline of all of this. So Governor Bailey introduced Executive Order 191 on the first day of session, and as you know, the legislature had 60 days to take action by coming together in a joint session to support the union. If no action in 60 days, then it becomes law with an effective date of July 1st, 2022. So how does this differ than what Fulton was passed forward last year? And then it's time. Time is the difference. The time before in which divisions go to each department is the same as Executive Order 119 that was introduced in 2021. But then polled with legislative legal noted some technical concerns in its drafting. These items have been corrected in the Department of Law, by the Department of Law, and specific areas of concern have been addressed with legislative legal. Prior to its official introduction, a draft is sent to legal to make sure that issues from the previous session were addressed in the current version before you all. You, as a committee members, rightly brought up that stakeholders needed to be engaged more. So we spent the past year doing robust stakeholder engagement on a weekly basis. We have done quality town halls, public town halls, met with tribes, tribal groups, tribal health consortiums, child welfare partners, child care providers and advocates, juvenile justice groups, senior groups, disability groups, health care providers. We truly worked hard to meet with groups that represent services that Health and Social Services provides. This engagement has been in formal meetings both during and after work hours, but also incorporated into routine interactions with outside groups, with myself, Deputy Commissioners, Policy Staff, and Directors, almost always leading the prospective reorganization into the discussion to find out their concerns. And even to keep a running joke among some groups that no matter the topic, they will bring up the reorganization. And I would say that these consistent, informal interactions were very beneficial because they occurred in smaller groups with much more spontaneous and insightful feedback. Throughout the process, we would respond to many different groups' concerns and questions in writing, and then follow up again to ensure that lingering questions were raised. And all of this constant engagement, we listened and incorporated feedback as necessary into our implementation plans. And as we demonstrated throughout this presentation, the sheer size of Health and Social Services means it's impossible for us to meet with every provider, advocate, or beneficiary about the reorganization. But I can say that we finished all of our meetings with links to the reorg website and an email address where questions, concerns, or meeting requests could be sent. Any groups that have reached out, last meetings we have met with, and we are still, we are still continuing these outreach meetings now. Our efforts and stakeholder engagement have been sincere. Absolutely necessary.
We have a question from Mr. Zogerson. Mr. Chair, Mr. Beck on page 24, so related to the timeline, can you talk about the bottom line cost to the state? I know that, that the department has said that the CCD order is not a cost savings measure. Can you talk about
the bottom line, you know, to the year program, what is the bottom line expense to the state to do this work? For the federal capacity, as I mentioned, we're coming up on that with its own slide in just a couple.
Okay.
continue. Thank you so much. So on slide 26, so the red clause in ISTA demonstrates just how the groups were on our beat with. Family's efforts being engaged with, listening to concerns of groups that initially spoke up about the reorganization. We also gained letters of support from key groups representing a diverse array of beneficiaries, advocates, and providers around the state. The support letters include the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, the Alaska Commission on Aging, the Alaska Pioneer Health Advisory Board, the Billford Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and the Alaska Geriatric Exchange Network, or AGE Network, which represents seniors and their caregivers. So from this engagement, we also learned things. Talk about with our tribal partners, and Mary discussed this, is about the tribal liaisons, which have been added to it. So the goal is to really maintain open lines of communication as we work with our tribal partners to address very serious concerns as we follow the Alaska. And then also, moving on, if it became clear that more regular and intentional interaction between departmental leadership and outside groups needs to happen, something will only be possible if another department is in the commissioner's office. The Alaska Children's Trust was the one who actually brought up the suggestion that we adopted over the organization transition to liaison. As the purpose of which, again, is to have a single point of contact that shareholders can share feedback, and that after implementation, we will continue to make sure that there are regular convening sessions for all groups. Such a big agency, and we believe we have a good handle on it. We always know inevitably there's going to be some program line or some server or database access which may be overlooked, and we want to make sure that all of our stakeholders have an opportunity to share with us what those are. And so we started over the last couple of weeks just in the same way as we continue to approach this, and this does look like it's going to become a law. Please start considering the groups and any task forces you want in order to meet with us. So we can give a list of things that this is taken care of and go down the list to make sure that that's going to work. And so that's kind of our engagement, was to know that we're not going to just sit and wait for July 1 to happen. We're continually working conversations and coming to the department, but also prepping all of our key stakeholder groups about what this means and how we can continue to make this as smooth as possible.
Thank you. Okay, let's take another question.
I'm slide 29, Representative Lukowski. So, what will it take to make this proposed solution reality? The strategic investments in 2 million in total funds, 11 new positions, and 10 new trial spot positions. As we've told the stakeholders over the past year, this is not a cost cutting or job cutting initiative. This is an appropriate size payroll initiative. For less than 0.06% of HESA's total budget, we can fund for reorganization. This is a smaller investment in prioritizing health services are delivered to vulnerable Alaskans and to allow entire bandwidth for each department to easily engage with stakeholders and partners on current initiatives and future innovations.
Commissioner, has the department done an assessment to determine, I think, sort of, I recall from the presentations that you made to the committee last year, there was an indication that beyond ongoing additional funds needed to facilitate this work, that some of it might be absorbed into existing staff, right, not the creation of additional positions, not additional capital costs, but really looking at this degree as an element of the transition and implementation that's simply absorbed by existing staff. Has the department done an assessment of the decline, the percent of time on existing resources beyond the $2 million in additional funds that would be needed to be absorbed by existing staff in order to facilitate the successful transition?
Just kind of a piece of the can I clarify if you're asking about the work we need to do for the transition or the transition?
To clarify, I think I would likely both. But I'm looking to better understand is there significant impact to staff time that takes away from the work that we need to provide direct services to our students. So whether it's during implementation or I would like to say during implementation, if there are percent of time and resources of impact to existing staff that really detracts from what their day-to-day functions might be.
Thank you for clarifying. Trying to turn over some of your capacity. Certainly there's kind of work that your company is making the majority on. We are a lot concerned about our ability to do that while still doing our regular business. The things that financial management services does, if there are things that need to happen to keep the department running smoothly, so that is not really an option for us to not.
Thank you.
person who brings in strongholds on the phone. Now, even here, looking at line 29,
Children Services does have its own internal Medicaid eligibility determination unit. It will continue to do so. That group will have a direct tie-in with the Department of Health Assistant ongoing and rehabilitative services that these children are eligible for. So that will be done because it's a cross department by MOU, or memorandum of agreement or understanding, to make sure that that is covered. Similar services include behavioral health, wellness department, or the Psychiatric Institute, and senior disability services for those well-recovered individuals in the Pioneer Homes, as well as public assistance across the Medicaid-eligible individuals and senior benefit-eligible individuals at the Pioneer Homes. So any of those cross-departments line of life that we're working to identify to make sure that we do have these formal data-sharing agreements. And actually, one aspect on this is if you've got ongoing family families or minor visits, they're all very large. Some of them are larger than other state departments. And sometimes, in the same house, sometimes families are doing the best to by being a separate department, you actually live formal data-sharing, like this is how you learn, right, when the planning firm is about the information goes back and forth. There are situations that may actually believe you will improve communication among some of these divisions. Thank you so much. I know about that. I remember plenty when was that meaningful engagement. And you asked us over and over. I hope we did get there. And it wasn't a big point for us to make sure that we continue to address it. And yes, it will be ongoing. I can actually hear tomorrow we're doing a phone call with the last attendant to us. This is, we're continuing to reach out and engage in these groups going forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
unrelated to the initiative and some delivery the disparities.
Government
at sending for additional services.
That's right.
And it'll happen in the administration.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. So we'll keep going.
So,
if you have a question.
Yeah, I had a question on the transfer of PCM over to the Department of Administration and Urban, IT personnel.
My records are going through the chair to have hands filed. No, they are accounting positions. I don't know if they will go into the Urban and Health Department initiative. It's been going on for a number of years.
Thank you. So, for when we talk about the implementation, so if after 60 days persons are not sort of visiting the authority funds on the effective dates of the reorganization, July 1st, 2022, or the start of FY23, for all of them, we stress that the rule will be changed. But what happens on the line one is the implementation of two departments, and finally, each person's office will have room to make administrative changes and processes that reach your own staff. Burns away from providers and obstacles clear for beneficiaries to receive services. If we do this right, there will be less time to change the report from June 30 to July 1. And over time, systems improvement can be put into action. Internally, we have worked to have all divisions provide input into necessary actions should the executive order become law. The following are some highlights. So we're trying to break this out with their phases. So this work shows that it has been ongoing for much longer than the year that has passed since the executive order was introduced in 2021. In addition, all these standalone engagement we have done with members of our budget subcommittee have seen in detail is making step towards implementation that's already been completed. That is dividing the budget into two departments. As I mentioned, the biggest impact is for support staff or being selected so they can support both their departments. In order to recreate the basis for the new departments, we had to determine the correct level of support and how long support staff appropriately. As mentioned before, there is never some a good time to do something like this, but the constitutional documents and executive orders must be dropped with first day of session that the state was organized. That being said, the behind-the-scenes work continues. Staff are meeting with our partners at the Departments of Administration and Transportation to plan for implementation and how to care for systems impacted at the Divisions of Finance, personnel labor relations, and the Office of Information Technology. Plus 60 days, once the EO becomes law, we can start notifying central partners and taking steps that require legal documentation. This would be things like getting the Department of Family and Community Services registered with CMI, that's the system for reward management that the federal government operates. The law executive order is a mechanism to point statutory authority to the correct department. The legislature has the power of appropriation and will continue our conversations and meetings with you, the appropriators, well after the post 60-day consideration. Much like a dinner party, where you can prepare everything in advance, but there are always things that can't be done until the last 5 minutes before the meal is served. We have a list of items to complete, similar to filling glasses with ice water and lighting the candles. We will have work queued up and ready, but we can't flip the switch until we're ready to sit down and eat. The last thing to occur prior to final implementation are transferring employees to the new departments, reiterating charging account to the new departments, and trying to encourage expenses on behalf of the new departments. As we look at the implementation phase, this time immediately after the effective date of July 1 will be consumed, just like it is every year, with closing the books on the previous fiscal year. Staff in both departments will work together to close the Department of Health and Social Services books one last time. Long term and beyond, we have items that we need that we know need longer term alignment than a period between March 18th and July 1. We plan to work through those items over the next year to thoughtfully and deliberately pull those pieces apart. We know this won't be without hiccups, that won't be a reasonable expectation, but we've been setting the stage for as smooth a transition as possible.
I think you mentioned the mentors in their comments. Make sure you're beforehand. I also want to echo Representative Small's comments with respect to the increased inquiry agenda that's been ongoing over the last year and a lot of people. One of the
discussions, meetings, and conversations of President Department had during this period of time as it relates to program recipient health, have allowed them to utilize this presence programs, and then what outreach to them to make sure that there's a smooth transition through the potential transition and implementation phase. So what does that look like?
There has not been, in the sense that our full communications with benefits recipients, we have not sent anything out publicly. We have tried to engage with advocacy groups and other individuals who represent folks receiving these services and they're aware of this. This is something that we do not process or some place and guidelines with the federal government and we need to notify to do any changes to the program. And so, this is going to be something that was sort of happening in April and May timeframe as we really lean into what this looks like. And that's when we would really reach out to last minute recipients directly through our formal process.
And when do you expect, can you give us just to help us out any framework of what that looks like? Can you give us a sense of the last thing that's been expected here from the department?
They gave a different bullet that will be disruptive to programs, but there are some that I believe we have to touch on with other programs towards that regard. And I think we have a plan for it. What is the best process on that?
Okay. We have a question from Representative Scott Holt.
Thank you, Chair. I am wondering if there are any kind of federal approval or state mandates that would need to be agreed with the federal government for in advance that we are going to have that July 1st.
Thank you for the record, Chair, to Representative Ronald. Thanks for that question. Allocation and modifications we have to make this year, not to buy no approval.
Thank you.
That's very important. So if you have one more question, then I'll jump in with you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at slide 32, specifically at the transition and implementation phase, is it the expectation of the department that both commissioner offices would be fully staffed instead of by the July 1st date, or what does that time frame look like in terms of standing up the two respective divisions?
We're not quite sure yet. We're trying to work with the Department of Law Canada to actually either name the new commissioners before the end of the department exists, or if it's law. And so there's like so many questions there between, if it's law versus effective date, is in terms of determinations that are being made. One thing that we can say is we initially do anticipate that posting and recruiting for those positions are inclined to do in advance of the July 1st. We say this would be data or finance staff, the IT staff, and other folks like that. And then we're hoping that, psychologically speaking, people will be excited about joining something new, right, to be part of that. And then we actually can fill and get a revenue staff, fully staff those who are going to quite some time.
So, are there any questions? I guess the first one is more of a comment. I'm still thinking of a stakeholder engagement. To date, most of the directional work sounds like it's going to be another formal process moving forward. But in our previous subcommittee meeting, we had an overview of the final report and the public consultation on the loss of land use strategy. And looking at Appendix A here, we summarized the stakeholder engagement and identified the main themes and how you might respond to that, and reflected in
So this is actually from Flip Bay that we were debating how can we do this in the cost factor more profitably and looking at our state telemeters declining that we have now in the school children and legislators help us with that. So this is a process that we can get engaged from. We very much appreciate the help and what is the best way over to get that input on these logos and how to put them together.
Great,
okay,
thank you. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Representative. Managing the supply that if it would be some of the providers will be wondering well how the heck is this going to work. And then the news media is going to take some time to get this out to the public. And that's always a challenge of thinking of private projects. They do a lot of public hearings, et cetera, but then they announce the project and people feel helpless and they just react.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Cox. So with that, we've actually been working on employee pay holds. And so we've managed this device with each division with massive numbers, hundreds of people attending each of them to ask questions directly to the devices we were shipping. You know, some of them like visual resistance and other concerns beyond the executive order, which like touching more different buildings, so we can just do a follow-up to kind of follow up on another list we'll do as well. So So that's how we're trying to do this. We've also released this. We have a whole communication called Commissioner's Death Letter, which goes out to all employees. That was how we were initially shared, and we shared that with the employees before we have the members' budgets that they heard from me first. And so we're trying to do that, and our next step is, if this does go into effect, it's actually then figuring out where are the areas that are going to have the most proper competition, and whether they want to actually do section-based, as opposed to, you know, 5 to 10-person divisions, but down to the 50 to 100-person sections, and give them access to make sure that they understand what's going on and what the expectations of them are.
That's good news. The other part of that is the media. Are they becoming aware of this and opportunity strange data?
For the chair representative Box, that I have not had any conversations with them. I have been in what was released in the government budget in December. I imagine after this hearing and the Senate House on Thursday, they will probably get some follow-up questions on this. So we'll kind of try to help that process. But you know, we're really respecting the timeline of the legislative process throughout this. We're not going to try to get too far out in front of this until we think this is going to become law or not.
Thank you. Except for the budget subcommittee when it comes out of PowerPoint. That doesn't really we have 9 minutes and 2 slides left, I believe, so we'll keep going. If there's any left, we'll have some time for some final questions.
So where do we go from here? There is more capacity for those to drive and lead organizations. There is more fuel in the tank to grow further than we've ever been able to go before. The outcomes of this one are not new. A lot of you have been involved with these issues for years, and we haven't seen the level of improvement for organizations that we want and need to see. Despite the efforts of OCS, the governor and the legislature, we haven't yet moved the needle on child welfare. The increasing vacancy rate of case carrying workers puts pressure on our entire system, families, and communities. To truly improve our child welfare system to support community prevention and post-family reunification, we will require focused attention and support from the commissioner's office that isn't pulled away by Medicaid or public health. For the Office for Pioneer Homes, we need to start having a long series of community-driven conversations about how to serve maintenance as addressed and what future investment should we be planning for. This requires a commissioner's office with a smaller span of control. Currently, Alaska is one of the last Medicaid states that is fit for service and doesn't have value-based care. Also, 1/3 of Alaskans are Medicaid eligible. This is greatly affect all health care and insurance costs in Alaska. Should this be addressed and worked on by a commissioner's office removed from API and OCS concerns? Prior experience clearly shows us that the existing structure of a single department will not allow for forward progress on all these serious items simultaneously. Nor can they be solved without active, consistent engagement with community partners and granted flexibility from federal partners. The time it stays created by adding 2 departments and 2 commissioners' offices allows these critical conversations to take place in earnest. Yes, crises will occur. But dealing with half as many divisions and issues allows the commissioner's offices and policy staff to facilitate their meetings with all parties so we can design our systems of care together. For the general public, for more information, we have our active website of reorg.thss.alaska.gov. And more questions or suggestions or feedback, please send us an email. We'll monitor this, any requests or town goals, let us know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner of New Jersey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think I really appreciate the Department of Energy today and all the work that we've been doing over the last year. Just in terms of any additional recovery efforts that the department has started going following the cyber attack. What's the chance that are still impacted by that, and does that cause any impediment in the reorganization efforts?
Thank you, Chair Representative Krakowski. There are still a couple systems that are down. Big primary ones that can start back up are recent one, which is a great deal of relief to our daily on hold grant recipient, because our payment system. to be able to do that through a digital process as opposed to where we can get the payments manually. That's what I was thinking about our process officers in Commissioner Ron, because again, as the deputy solicitor also had an IT
Thank you, Commissioner.
Do you think
you're representing the company? First of all, I need to say that I don't disagree. I just have a little job that I have very, very hard work that they need to do. We are making good progress in regard to the cyber attack. It has not been as quick as we would have liked. One thing that we really learned with the cyber attack, so it did happen so that in May. And thankfully, I thought immediately to realize that we were up against a very cyber security entity that was trying to. Infiltrate our systems. And so we did this entire contractor, which is a little that provides help to agencies, multinational corporations, other governments that are under cyber attack. And it really helped us isolate the systems that needed to be brought offline. And so it really limited the scope of the attack. So just for a little bit of context, we took 19 systems offline. So at this point, the commissioners are happy to have nine systems that are still in the office going through recovery. One of the things that we have worked with told us is that we really needed to rebuild the systems. So instead of we have found even back on any week, because we have disaster recovery and we have other copies of all of our information that we could refer to, what the advice that they gave us was that the safe thing to do is to rebuild from the ground up, and that's been a time consuming part of this. So, those 23 steps that they go through in order to bring things back online. And so, we have nine applications that are still in some order of those 23 steps. And the last step that they do is to do what they call penetration testing, which is trying to get the bad guy and basically go around the doors and drive the windows and see if. And so that's the last thing we do before we bring things back online to ensure that everything is as robust as can be and that things are being heard and everything that we want to do.
And then just to clarify, in terms of any impacts to the reorganization efforts, has there been, as you continue to go, have there been any impediments to moving forward?
Through the chair, Representative Sokowski. That really starts back a little on and a regular field basis to see what we were doing. But we are moving forward, and we do have resources that were requested in the budget to assist us with hiring some contractors to help our IT staff and state executive them.
Sorry, I just have one more follow-up question as it relates to the dialogue that you had with Charter Snyder on the investment of the roughly $2 million for the transition. Is that purely the expense that PCMs open the transition, or does that $2 million also include transition, the salvage, any cost for pillow development? Any transitions for online applications, as well as cleaning printed materials. I think Representative Sayer had asked that question, but I didn't want to specifically understand whether those costs were included in the community or whether that was purely the staff position expense. Through the chair, Representative Sokowski, about $1.9 million is commercial services, so it is for the position on our request for donations. Thank you so much. Final question from Representative Fox.
Thank you, Commissioner Snyder. I guess getting back to the public relations part of this, the part of it that I'm the most concerned about and have to deal with most is the office job services. If you're not doing this just for the sake of reorganizing, but what are you going to be focusing on, particularly in job services, in the year after the organization? And for the family, how is this going to help the families, help the children,
pages and we're going to box looking for that information. But initially, it's the recruitment of those aspects. OCS being reactive organization, one of the things that you're really trying to work on is actually how do we put more permission in the community. This is something we've seen in the craft is going to use more requests of increasing the traffic travel through compact in order to give more permission to services and community. So other items like that, you know, we want to ensure that we get better technologies and we actually can take care of our staff families for accessing data faster and then we can transfer back and forth. Our primary need in order to improve the system is to come back with the permission and getting our staff input so that we can actually get answers better, faster to get there, and also the families we meet. But they're not lingering and waiting because once staff member were to leave, it means the ones that are left behind, their caseload is even longer. Takes time to get blessed or needs to get pushed, and it's this very vicious cycle that we're trying to get out in front of it really correct.
Thank you. I really appreciate the presentation today and the amount of work that's gone into this. I think it's going to be a success. I think that this is going to enable both agencies and markets to improve their work going forward. So I expect that.
Thank you, Commissioner Dudley, Commissioner. At this point, I say thank you to everyone for a productive meeting. Clearly, a lot of work is gone into this, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. On that note, we currently have a meeting that has continued this conversation on Thursday, February 10th, from 3 to 3:30, just for a half hour ahead of budget subcommittee. And I will draw commissioners' attention to the remaining documents that we received from the department we did not get to across the day. So we'll have the opportunity to have this on Thursday, but we also have